Thank you. It's a delight to be here, and I am here. Let me put my cards on the table. I am an evangelical Christian who is part of the Southern Baptist tradition, and I'm delighted to talk about the subject of Christianity in Israel, but I need to begin that by some caveats or some qualifiers. I'm going to talk mainly about Protestant Christianity, because that's what I know more about. And secondly, there is a division within Protestant Christianity that runs through most of our denominations, including Baptists, between those who believe in what is called replacement theology. That is a belief that the Jews were God's chosen people in the Old Covenant or the Old Testament. But with the coming of the New Testament, with the coming of the New Covenant and Jesus as the Messiah, that the church is now the chosen people of God, that the church has replaced Israel. There's a second theology, and that's the one that I personally espouse, and I think it's safe to say that the majority, significant majority of Southern Baptists espouse, and that is that that the church is the church and Israel is Israel, and that God made a covenant with the Jews, and it is an unconditional covenant, and it is a forever covenant, so that the Jews are still God's chosen people, that God made certain promises to them as Jews that he didn't make to us as Gentiles, for those of us who are Gentiles. And one of those promises was the land of Canaan. He promised them the land of Canaan forever. In Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3, and I will bless, it says, I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great. He's speaking to Abraham now, and thou shalt be a blessing, and I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curseth thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And the covenant that God made with Abraham, which is known in theological circles as the Abrahamic covenant, promises that Abraham will have unlimited divine blessing, fame, and influence. In fact, that there is a mandate for them to be a blessing to the world, that Abraham will be protected by God, that Abraham's blessings will be extended to his seed, God will bless those that bless his children, and he will curse those that curse his children. I was sharing this with a reporter from the Los Angeles Times, and she said, well, but the Arabs say that they're of the seed of Abraham too, so they're part of the blessing. I said, well, you know, I said, Abraham tried that. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, do you have a Bible there? And she said, and she was the religion reporter, and she said, well, I think I can find one. And so I waited till she found one, and I said, now, in chapter 17 God of Genesis, God reiterates his promise to his children, to Abraham, and he says, and I will, verse 16, I will bless her and give thee a son also of her, and she shall be a mother of nations, kings of people shall be of her. Then Abraham fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old? And shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear? And Abraham said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. So Abraham is saying, I believe this promise that you've given me, God, but I'm an old, old man. My wife's an old woman. Let my son Ishmael find favor in thy sight. And God said, Sarah, thy wife, shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him, and I will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. Last time I checked, there are about 300 million Arabs in the world. And if you consider oil a blessing, they've been blessed. But the covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year. So for those of us who believe that the church has not replaced Israel, that the church is the church and Israel is Israel, then those promises that God made to Abraham and to his seed through Isaac are still in force. Among them, that the land of Canaan would be given to his seed forever. Now, a lot of people thought that was pretty outlandish. How could anybody believe that? There are no Jews in what was Israel until the 20th century. And then all of a sudden it began to seem a little more plausible because you had a lot of Jews moving to a place where Jews had not been for close to 1900 years. And then after World War II and after the Holocaust, even larger numbers of Jews began to migrate to their ancestral homeland. And Hebrew, which was really as a living language, other than just for the study of the Bible and for worship, had not lived in many centuries, became a living language. Hebrew was resurrected. If you go to Israel today, you see signs in Hebrew. And you had the Jewish people migrating back to Palestine, back to the land of Canaan that God had promised to his people forever. In earthly terms, it's difficult to imagine how this could have happened. I mean, there are no Hittites. There are no Assyrians. The Egyptians that live in Egypt are not the Egyptians who lived there in ancient times. There are no Babylonians. There's no Babylonian language. But the Jews are back. As of last count, there are 5.2 million Jews between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And I don't think they're going anywhere. They're there. And they believe this is their homeland. It was given to them by God. And a sizable portion of Protestant Christianity in the United States agrees with them. A more sizable portion than ever before. I've seen this happen in my own lifetime in Southern Baptist life. I have seen the belief that God gave the land of Israel to the Jews forever and that God has this special covenant with them go from being a significant minority in Southern Baptist life to being a significant majority in Southern Baptist life. And the key event has been the reappearance of Israel as a nation and as a people in what had been the land of Canaan. Now, one of the significant figures in this was Harry Truman. And Harry Truman had a Baptist grandmother who believed this. It's interesting how things work out. Harry Truman had a Baptist grandmother who was a very staunch Bible-believing Baptist. And she used to talk to Harry about the Jews as God's chosen people. And people who know President Truman say that this played a significant part in his decision, against the advice of the State Department, against the advice of his Secretary of State, against the advice of his Secretary of Defense, against the advice of the French, which is probably a good reason for doing it, against the advice of all of our Western European allies, and against the advice of all of the Arab countries in the region, the United States recognized the Jewish state of Israel right after the UN vote, and it was absolutely essential to Israel's survival as a state, because once the United States of America recognized the Israeli state, they were able to get the loans that were necessary to defend themselves, because people sometimes forget that when Israel was declared an independent state, they were immediately attacked by all five of the surrounding Arab nations. All five of them, within 48 hours, attacked the Jewish settlements and tried to drive the Jews off the land that the UN had partitioned as the free Jewish state. And as Abba Ibn, the eloquent former foreign minister and UN ambassador of Israel, said, the Arab refugee problem is a significant problem, and the world needs to deal with it. But we need to understand that if the fortunes of war had gone in the other direction, there would have been no Jewish refugees. Because in the few instances where the Arabs were successful in overrunning Jewish settlements, they killed everyone in the settlement. There weren't any refugees, they just slit their throats. They killed them. The proportion of Christians who believe that God, the Jews are God's still chosen, are still God's chosen people, that God has a special covenant with them, that God blesses those who bless them and God curses those who curse them. I would say that this is a significant majority of Southern Baptists. It's a significant majority of the charismatic movement, a significant majority of the Bible church movement, and it would be probably among evangelical denominations at least 50-50 beyond those. The replacement theology is largely dominant in the mainline denominations, in Presbyterianism, in Methodism, in Episcopalianism. Those denominations would largely be followers of replacement theology. Now, this is not a new division in American church history, because going all the way back to colonial days, if any of you have studied the Mathers in colonial American history, Cotton and Increase Mather believed in, now you've got to remember, this is in the 17th century. There were no Jews in Palestine. They believed that biblical prophecy said that the Jews were going to return to Palestine, that God was going to redeem his promise of a homeland for the Jews in the ancient land that God had given to them. Jonathan Edwards believed this. Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century was a strong proponent of this continuing covenant between Israel, the Jews, Israel, and God. But it was a minority viewpoint. I would say probably today, since the reestablishment of the Jewish state in 1948 and the flourishing of the Jewish state over the last half century, the percentage of American Protestants who have adopted this belief has grown exponentially. Now, this is good news for supporters of Israel, because people who believe this believe, number one, that the Jews are God's chosen people, that God gave that land to them, and that they have a right to be there. And number two, that God blesses those who bless the Jews, and God curses those who curse the Jews. And since most of us want God to bless us, and since most of us want God to bless our country, we want America to bless the Jews. I was taught this at my mother's knee when in 1956, when the Suez crisis was going on, and I remember, I think it was John Cameron Swayze and the Camel News Caravan was on, and they were talking about the British and the French and the Israelis going to the Suez Canal to retake it from the Egyptians who had taken it from the British. And my mother was making biscuits in the kitchen, and she said, "Now, Richard, you remember last week we saw that history program that showed Germany in 1945, and it showed the planes flying over Germany, and it showed the flattened cities, and it talked about how 9 million Germans were killed, and it talked about how perhaps as many as 500,000 German women were raped by the Soviet Army as the Soviet Army came into Eastern Germany, and it talked about how Germany was divided down the middle." She said to me, "That's what happens when you curse the Jews. If you curse the Jews, God sends judgment upon you." And you know, I've thought about that. One of my hobbies is reading 20th century world history. Three countries that were probably the three most anti-Semitic countries in the 19th and early 20th century were Germany, Russia, and Poland. And I don't think there's any country in the world other than those three countries that would trade places with those three countries and their history in the 20th century. It's my firm conviction that one of the reasons God has blessed this nation, and we certainly have been blessed to the extent that he has, is because we have been the least anti-Semitic country in the West. That doesn't mean anti-Semitism doesn't exist, but we've been the least anti-Semitic country. As Joe Lieberman, I had the privilege of being on Meet the Press with Joe Lieberman last Easter. And as Joe Lieberman said, he said, this country's been a faith-based initiative from the beginning. And he says the people who came here and founded this country came and founded a country where there was religious freedom for all, and they've extended it now, not just to Christians, but to Jews and to Muslims and to Hindus. And he said, except for certain periods in Israel's history, Jews have had more freedom of religion and more freedom of expression in the United States of America than they have anywhere else in the world. And he said, that is the gift, and that is the promise, and that is the glory of the people who founded this country and who have lived out the promises of their founding documents. And, you know, I was on there with Lieberman and a few others, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to be quiet. I mean, as long as Senator Lieberman's doing this good a job, I'm just going to be quiet and let him make my points for me. I've been to Israel several times. The last time was 2 years ago. I was there as part of the process that Lord Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, was helping to promote, and that was the religious groups helping to bring along the peace process, the Muslims, the various Christian groups, because as you may know, there are a lot of Palestinians who are Christians. There's a higher percentage of the Arab population in the West Bank and Gaza who are Christians, or at least used to live there, than any other Arab country except Lebanon. So that there's a lot of Christians on the West Bank and Gaza. And we went there to help along the peace process. And I must confess, I came back more optimistic than I was before I went. And the reason was I found a lot of Israelis who were very deeply committed to the peace process, which didn't surprise me that much, because I think, you know, I don't think there's any question. If the Arabs wanted peace as badly as the Israelis want peace, there would be peace. But what I found that was encouraging to me was I found among the Palestinian population on the West Bank a far more significant number of people who were willing to work toward a two-state solution and to a lasting peace with Israel than I had expected there to be. I remember being at one particular event where there were some Jewish rabbis, Israeli rabbis, and there were some Arab sheikhs. And one of the rabbis took the hand of his friend, who was an Arab sheikh, a Palestinian, and he said, I believe that God gave this land to me and my people forever. But there's nothing in my Bible, he says, that says I can't give some of this land to my neighbor, taking the hand of this Arab sheikh, if it will make peace between our two peoples. I was reminded of that when I had the extraordinary privilege and the extraordinary opportunity to spend 2.5 hours with Simon Peres, one of these giants of history, one of these guys who's lived history, who's just got this command of all the facts. And he said, you know, he said, there are three factors that make it absolutely essential and make it a foregone conclusion that there will be a two-state solution. Number one, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, there are 5.2 million Jews and there are 4.9 million Arabs. And he said, that's the first fact. The second fact is, we are going to remain a Jewish state. The third fact is, we are going to remain a democratic state. He said, you take those three facts together, and there has to be a two-state solution where the 5.2 million Jews and the 1.7 million Arabs who are citizens of Israel live in the state of Israel, which is, and then you have the rest of the 4.9 million Arabs living in a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza with and with a democratically elected government that agrees to live at peace with its neighbor Israel. And he said, you know, it may be that we may not be able to live together in peace, but we can live side by side in peace. And he said, you know, he said he had great confidence that was going to happen. He says the Palestinians, he said the Arab terrorists are fighting against modernity, and they can't win. They may have put up a good fight, but he said ultimately they can't win because they're fighting modernity. And when you fight modernity, you will end up losing. I hope he's right. I hope he's right, because I must confess, that, to digress for a moment, I must confess that the more I look at the situation today as a student of history, you can plug in Tehran for Berlin, and you can plug in the president of Iran for Adolf Hitler, and you can plug in radical Islamic fascism for National Socialism, and you can come up with some pretty rough parallels to the kind of threat that the world will face in the next decade if we don't deal with the threat of Islamofascism in this decade, in the way that in the 1930s they didn't deal with it, and they ended up having 55 million dead people by the time the Second World War was over. But I think that it's clear that in the United States, that the Israelis can have no stronger friend, no more loyal friend, than evangelical Christians who believe in the continuing covenant with Israel. And I think that that has been demonstrated over the past 30 or 40 years, and will continue to be demonstrated. I get calls whenever B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League attack me, you know, and the reporter says, well, do you still support Israel? I said, yes, I just turned the other cheek. There's nothing that the Anti-Defamation League can say about me that's going to cause me to say anything but good things about the right of Israel to exist within secure borders and to live at peace with its neighbors. Now, that doesn't mean I give Israel a blank check. I know the Israelis aren't perfect, but there is no moral equivalence between the Israelis and their opposition, any more than there was moral equivalence between the Soviet Union and the United States. We weren't perfect, but there was no moral equivalence between us and the Soviet Union. There's no moral equivalence between Israel on the one hand and Hezbollah and Hamas on the other. And you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to make perfection the enemy of the good. There is no moral equivalence between the two. And I guess one example of that would be in the round before last of fighting, the Israelis went into two refugee camps where terrorists were hiding in, and they discovered about 12 bomb-making factories. And they took 27 dead soldiers as casualties in order to try to separate between combatants and non-combatants. They went into the camps because the camps were military targets, because there were bomb-making factories in there, and they were being used as sanctuaries by terrorists that were blowing up Israeli citizens. But instead of just pulling their tanks up and blowing the place down to the ground, they went in street by street trying to discern between civilians and combatants. I have seen Hamas and Hezbollah and any of the Islamofascist groups have never done anything like that, and certainly have not been willing to take casualties in order to make distinctions between the two. Now, let me hasten to add that I have known President Bush since 1988. I do have contacts with this administration on an ongoing basis. I was appointed to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom by President Bush for two terms before I was appointed by Senator Frist. And I can tell you without any fear of hesitation that I have never run into anybody in the Bush administration who has made policy on the Middle East based on anything other than the doctrine that has been the doctrine of United States foreign policy since 1948 under Harry Truman. And it's been true under Democrat presidents and Republican presidents, that America supports Israel and Israel's right to exist within secure borders and at peace with her neighbors, and that it is in the best interest of the United States to support the only stable democracy in the Middle East. In other words, I haven't seen any Left Behind novels on bookshelves in the West Wing. I've never heard the president make any comment, or any of the president's advisors make any comments. I mean, all of this supposed influence of prophecy is a product of the fevered brains of people like Randall Balmer and Kevin Phillips, who have way too much time on their hands and overactive imaginations. And with that, I think I'll stop and let you ask questions. Yes, sir.
Can I ask you, what role does proselytizing Jews play in the relationship between the division or the discussion you talked about, the different perceptions of Israel? What role does proselytizing play? Does it play a role, and how is that distinguished from
I think that the question was about proselytizing Jews, i.e. witnessing to Jews. Let's take first of all that segment of American Protestant Christianity that believes that God has a continuing covenant with the Jews. The vast majority of that group, who are large or evangelical Christians, charismatic, Pentecostal, Southern Baptist, etc., believe that that covenant has to do with nation status and with promises that are made that are outside the question of the gospel salvation. In other words, they would say Paul was a Jew, Paul the Apostle, and he said there's one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. The Apostle Peter was a Jew, who said in Acts chapter 4, there's no other name under heaven by which men can be saved. And Jesus, who was a Jew, which, you know, I've always wondered about people like the Klan. You know, you don't expect them to be terribly rational. But, I mean, good grief, Jesus was a Jew. How can you be anti-Semitic as a Christian? Jesus was a Jew. I mean, you know, it just seems, but I guess expecting rationality on the part of the Klan is like, you know, asking a bug to speak. But they would argue that salvation is still in Jesus and Jesus alone. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. And they would take it further and say that Paul the Apostle in Romans 1 says you're to go to the Jew first and then to the Greek. So if we know that there are Jews around, we need to make sure we go talk to them about the gospel. Understanding, of course, that witness is an act of love for evangelical Christians, not an act of hate. I had a rabbi tell me once, he said, Richard, if you really respected my faith, you wouldn't seek to share Jesus with me. And I said, well, you know, if the price of respecting your faith is to disrespect mine, the price is too high. Because my faith has something in it called the Great Commission, to go into all the world and preach the gospel to the Jew first and then to the Greek. Now, if you say to me, I don't want to hear it, or thank you for sharing it with me, but that, you know, I don't want to hear it, that's your privilege, that's your prerogative. I've fulfilled my responsibility to non-coercively seek to share my faith. Now, there is a minority within that evangelical group that believes that the Jews have a separate covenant for salvation. Guy in San Antonio.
John Hagee.
John Hagee would believe this. It's a small group. It's not a large group, but there's a small group within this community who believes that the Gentiles have one way of salvation and the Jews have a different way of salvation that is separate from Jesus and separate from the Gentiles. Now, when it comes to the people who believe in replacement theology, it depends on whether they're conservative or whether they're liberal. People like D. James Kennedy and other sort of traditional mainline Protestants would still believe in evangelism. But then the more liberal you get, you know, I mean, that's like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree. And you know, you get as many different answers as you would have liberal mainline pastors. Yes, sir.
You kind of touched on this at the end when you were talking about prophecy and the Left Behind stuff, but I am under the impression that, like, a lot of the support for Israel, the evangelical community, I won't say a lot, but there's been, like, a significant portion that I've read about, seen about, and actually seen with my own eyes, where I'm from, rural Alabama, that is based on people are giving money to the Israel cause because, like, the Book of Revelation states, they want the Temple Mount rebuilt so the apocalypse can take place. And that's, you know, to put it in a nutshell, that's what I've seen the motivation a lot, like, do you think that that's a sizable percentage of like what this is? And like, you don't subscribe to that personally or anything, do you?
Well, number one, what I do subscribe to as a disciple of Jesus is I believe Jesus when he says no man knows the hour or the day of his coming. That means no man, not even John Hagee. That means no one on Trinity Broadcasting. No one knows. And people who think they know don't. And, you know, there have always been people who thought so. I could show you lots of materials that are, you know, that are collecting dust in libraries now, that Mussolini was the Antichrist and that Jesus was coming back, that Hitler was the Antichrist, that Stalin was the Antichrist, that Napoleon was the Antichrist. That was a big movement, that Napoleon was the Antichrist as he became emperor and he was going to restore the Roman Empire. And so do I believe that, as an evangelical Christian, I believe that the description of the situation in the world when the Lord comes back is that the Jews are significant in the land of Israel, which people thought was sort of strange until 1948. Not so strange anymore. And that there is temple worship in Jerusalem. But whether that's going to happen next year or that's going to happen 1,000 years from now, my Bible tells me I don't know. So I don't spend much time thinking about it. And I don't think most evangelical Christians do. I hear a lot from people who don't know evangelical Christians that all of this support for Israel is because we're trying to accelerate the second return of the Lord. I personally don't know any evangelical Christians who believe that. I just know people who think evangelical Christians believe that. I don't know any personally who do. There may be some. I don't know any. And I know a lot of evangelical Christians. I also should say to you, because this always surprises non-Baptist audiences, but I think you need to know. I have been a Southern Baptist. I've been a conscious Southern Baptist for a little more than half a century. In July of 1946, George Bush was born. In August of 1946, Bill Clinton was born. In November of 1946, Laura Bush and I were born. All of us are going to be 60 this year. I have never heard an anti-Semitic comment, never heard an anti-Semitic joke. I've never heard an anti-Semitic reference in that entire time in Southern Baptist life from anybody. The first time I ever heard an anti-Semitic comment was when I was a freshman at Princeton from an Italian Catholic from Massachusetts. And I actually didn't know the derogative term that he used for Jews. I didn't know what it was. I had to go ask somebody, what is that? I didn't know what it was. So I would say that for people who are evangelical Christians, who especially the ones who accept this continuing covenant, the idea of anti-Semitism just never occurs to them. I mean, how can you be prejudiced against God's chosen people? And if you were, you wouldn't be blessed by God. So there's sort of a self-protective element as well. So no, I think I've read the same stuff you read, and I just don't see it among evangelicals. Certainly among Southern Baptists, I don't see it. Because the controlling premise is, Jesus said, no man knows the hour or the day of his coming. And now, I will say this, and I do believe this from the core of my being. Any time you see anti-Semitism, anytime you see hostility or hatred of Jews, you can take it to the bank that there's satanic involvement in that. Because I believe that there is evil in the world and that Satan is active in the world and that he hates the Jews precisely because they are God's chosen people. And that whenever you see anti-Semitism at work, whether it's in the Ku Klux Klan, or whether it's in Hitler's Germany, or whether it's in Stalin and Khrushchev's Russia, or whether it's in Iran, where they're going to convene a conference on the exaggerations of the Holocaust. Well, I got news for Abed Abadou. I've been to Auschwitz. I've been to Dachau. There is no exaggeration. The most scientifically advanced, medically advanced, educationally advanced country in the world conspired to kill every Jew they could get their hands on during World War II, and they killed 6 million of them. And they had plans for ovens in New Jersey if they'd won the war. And I don't think any of us are going to question that there was satanic input into the Third Reich. Yes?
Are the Arabs in Palestine a homogenous group? Are they all Muslim or all Christian? What's the difference?
I'm sorry?
The Arabs in Palestine?
Yeah.
Are there any Christians among them?
There used to be a lot. They're leaving. Since the Palestinian Authority gained control over the West Bank, after the Israelis ceded control of the West Bank to the Palestinian Authority, and this was true under Fatah, as before Hamas, they placed an intifada tax on all Palestinian Christians, because the Palestinian Christians overwhelmingly didn't participate in the intifada. And so the Fatah government imposed a tax upon them because they had not taken part of the intifada. And they've also confiscated their businesses, and they've forced them to sell them at extortionary rates. About half of the Christians who live in the West Bank and Gaza have left, which is unfortunate for lots of reasons, not the least of which is they were disproportionately the most educated part of the population. So that the population is increasingly Muslim. It's gone from about, I think, when Israel still controlled the West Bank from 67, you know, from 67 until, what, 2002, 2003, the Israelis had operational control of the entirety of the West Bank and Gaza. There were about 25% of the population of the Arab population of Palestine was Christian. In Israel, there's a sizable minority of the Arab Israelis. There are 1.7 million Arab Israelis who are Israeli citizens and who vote in Israeli elections. A sizable minority of them are Christian. But increasingly, on the West Bank and in Gaza, it's becoming a totally Muslim population by withdrawal of the Palestinian Christians under pressure and prejudice. Yes?
If religion was completely taken out of the mix and you were in the position of a government, do you think you'd still be able to support Israel's existence?
Yeah. How could I not?
Well, if religion was not a part of it.
If religion was not a part of it, how could I not? I mean, most people in our country do and have. I mean, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan because he had come out in favor of selling F-16s to Israel. Harry Truman, a Democrat, recognized Israel over the protestations of Acheson and over the protestations of Marshall. Eisenhower had the same policy. Kennedy had the same policy. Johnson had the same policy. Every American president from Truman forward has had the same policy toward the Israelis. In fact, the first president in our history to come out in favor of a Palestinian state was George W. Bush. And that's actually quite a feat. He's the first president in American history since Israel's existence to come out in favor of an independent Palestinian state. And at the same time, Ariel Sharon says that he's the best president of the United States that Israel's ever had. That's quite a pirouette. How could I not? The Israelis are a democracy, a self-governing democracy. They were attacked by all five of their neighbors who sought to drive them into the sea and kill them. They're attacked by their Arab neighbors who won't live in peace with them, side by side. The Israelis have withdrawn from Gaza. They have, as I've said, the Israelis aren't perfect. But if the Arabs wanted peace as badly as the Israelis do, there'd be peace. Just like in you know, America wasn't perfect. I hope this isn't a shock to you. America wasn't perfect in the Cold War. But if the Russians had wanted peace as badly as we wanted peace, there would have been peace. The problem is that the people who are in control of the governments in a significant part of the Arab world deny Israel's right to exist. It's pretty hard to negotiate with people who deny your right to exist. Although I must confess, on some days I do like Walter Russell Mead, who's the Henry Kissinger Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He said, you know, he was asked one time if there were any regrets he had over the last half century of American foreign policy. And he said, well, maybe one. He said, maybe we should have declared Bavaria the national homeland of the Jews. And then when the Germans complain, say, oh, shut up. Yes, sir.
Got another one, sorry. I think according to like AIPAC and the other pro-Israel lobbies and stuff, AIPAC, American Israeli Political Action Committee, Israel is getting close to like about $3 million a year for the United States in foreign aid. Do you think, and I think that's the highest foreign aid amount we have going to any one particular country, do you think that...
Not anymore.
Who, then what's...
Iraq.
The, okay, well, yes.
It's not nearly as high as Iraq.
Do you think that amount of money is better spent in Israel, or be better spent like any humanitarian effort somewhere in like sub-Saharan Africa or something like that? Like, do you think that dollar amount...
Well, I don't think it's neither or. I don't think it's an either-or choice. I do think that the Jews have a peculiar claim on the world's conscience. Don't you?
In terms of...
The Holocaust. The world's conscience, not just Europe's conscience, the world's conscience. We let it happen. We didn't let Jews come to this country who wanted to immigrate prior to the war. And, you know, I must confess, when I was 17 years old, I had a wonderful history teacher who had us reading primary documents, and I read Mein Kampf. And I went to my parents, my dad was a World War II veteran, my mother graduated from high school in 1941. My dad graduated in 1940. I said, didn't anybody read this book? It's all here. He wrote it all down in a book in 1929. And people said, oh, he's just a nut. Well, yeah, he was. Till he got control of a country. And he began to implement what he said he was going to implement. I mean, you know, anybody who had any doubt after the 1935 enactment of the Nuremberg Laws, there wasn't any doubt where this was going.
So you see this as like reparation, I guess, from the Holocaust this year?
I think they have a peculiar claim on the world's conscience, yes.
So, I mean, just to ask you then, would you be, kind of like that same line of reasoning, would you be in favor of reparations for African Americans in the U.S. for slavery?
No, because none of the slaves are alive.
I would make an argument
that the Great Society is about as close to reparations as we're going to come. Let's see, $12-15 billion, most of it spent to deal with people who were disadvantaged by slavery and by segregation. As bad as slavery was, and I think slavery was terrible, and I've said so in numerous different places. In fact, I've argued for a National American Holocaust Museum in Washington, in which we would recreate a slave ship and park it next to Jefferson's Memorial in the Tidal Basin, and conduct tours of what it was actually like. They have models of human beings packed in like they were packed into slave ships, and where they factored in a 1/3 death rate on the crossing. But the world stood by while 6 million Jews were gassed and shoved into ovens. And we were complicit. In 1943, our intelligence agencies, with aerial photography, identified the extermination camps and what they were. And the decision was made by Franklin Roosevelt and General of the Army, Chief of Staff Marshall, that we had higher priority targets, military targets, than blowing up the ovens. That was an immoral decision. We should have blown up the ovens. It wouldn't have been possible to exterminate 6 million people if we'd blown up the chambers and blown up the ovens, because you just can't shoot people that fast. So I think that as long as their Arab neighbors are sworn to their extermination and are sworn to drive them into the sea, I think the United States and every other country in the world has a moral obligation to help them defend themselves against annihilation.
Yeah,
I do. Other questions? Yes.
I'm sorry. Thank you so much for your very interesting point of view. I'm from Russia, from Soviet Union, was born, and I just want to add that when in 1948 United Nations Declaration was established, and Great Britain gave the freedom for Palestine, Soviet Union was among the countries who support Israel, because in Russia, as you know, a lot of Jewish are living at that period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now in Israel, half of the population of Israel came from Russia, maybe more.
Yes.
So it is interesting point of view. But when you again talk about the city which was totally destroyed at the end of Second World, it was not Soviet Union who put the bomb to the Dresden.
Oh.
Maybe you don't know.
Oh, I know. I know all about it. I know all about Dresden. And and I'm not complaining.
No, no, no.
I think Dresden actually was a war crime. But
war is absolutely unbelievable violation of every human right. And when we're talking about Israel and Christianity, first of all, we are talking about freedom of conscience and religion. And in this point of view, of course, the United States is the greatest country who supports the freedom of religions. And I believe that in the future, you will continue this achievement. But step by step, the rest of Christianity understand better the mistakes. And as you know, the Pope make mercy for Jewish for Holocaust. And what is the reason I am talking here? Because it is very young people sitting here. It is our future. And I hope in future,
thank you. And thanks to Ronald Reagan and George Shultz, half the population of Israel is Jewish because the Soviet Union wouldn't let them leave. They were called refuseniks. They wanted to leave. They weren't allowed to leave. And Reagan and Shultz made it part of every discussion we had with the Soviet government until finally they let them go. Interestingly, to show you some of the, I mean, I'm not real happy, but I was in Russia this last summer as well. Some things are going well, some things are not going so well. But it is interesting, for the first time since the mid-80s, there are more Jews leaving Israel and going back to Russia than there are Jews leaving Russia and going to Israel. And the main reason is that, I don't know if you knew this or not, but Russia's income tax rate is 12%. It's a flat tax. In other words, the Russian tax rates are a whole lot lower than ours. And they're a whole lot lower than the Israelis, who have very high tax rates. So a lot of Russian Jews who had migrated from the old Soviet Union to Russia are going back because of the burgeoning economic opportunities in Russia, and because anti-Semitism has to a significant degree died down. It's still there, but it's not nearly as bad as it was. And so there a lot of Jews are going back, there's about half the population of Israel that is Jewish. They came from Russia. There's no question about that. But Ronald Reagan and George Shultz were the reason they got to leave. Okay, other questions? And by the way, war is terrible. The only thing worse than there are things worse than war. However, a world controlled by the Third Reich is worse than war. You need to remember that some things are worse than war. Yes?
On a slightly different avenue, given the degree to which many Arabs on the ground may equate Westernization with Christianity, in supporting Israel, how do we fight the hardening of the minds of some Arab countries against evangelism?
Well, that's a different question. I think, first of all, to equate Westernization with Christianity is doing a disservice to Christianity, because there are lots of parts of Westernization that Christianity finds just as distasteful as traditional Muslims would, the pornography, the hedonistic lifestyles, which seem to be part of Westernization. I must confess to you that I have seldom been sadder in my life than I was in 1999 when my wife and I went to the Baptist World Alliance meeting in Dresden. And we flew into Vienna, and we rented a car, and we were driving from Vienna to Dresden. And when we crossed over the border from Austria into Czechoslovakia, for the next 6 miles, at every stop in the road and all along the road and at every bend in the road, there were young girls in their mid to late teens in various states of undress, selling their bodies in prostitution to anyone who stopped. And my wife and I don't think I've ever had an experience quite like it. My wife and I, when we finished, we got to an open place. I looked at my wife, and she had tears running down her face, and I had tears running down my face because, you know, we both had teenage girls, and it was just heartbreaking to see. That's part of Westernization. It's not the most attractive part. I think that what we have to do is, first of all, separate being American from being Christian, being Western from being Christian, when you're talking about evangelism. I think as Christians we have to separate ourselves from our national identity when we become missionaries to these other countries. And interestingly enough, there are more Muslim people of Muslim heritage and Arab heritage who are Christians today than probably at any time in the 20th century, in the last 100 years. There's a lot of growth of, in fact, one of the things that's going on in your lifetime that is absolutely astounding and was absolutely unforeseen by any so-called expert is the Christianization of the Second and Third World. There's a new book out about this that talks about this. At current growth rates, for the first time in history, in 40 years, the majority of professing Christians in the world will be non-white. They'll be Asian and African. Africa will become a majority Christian continent in 25 years at current growth rates. When the bamboo curtain came down in China in 1949, there were between 5 and 8 million Christians in China when all the missionaries had to leave. When the bamboo curtain came up in 1989, there were about 80 million Christians in China. Now it's conservatively estimated that there are 120 million Christians in China, and I was there last summer, and it's unbelievable what's going on in China. It's just absolutely unbelievable. And what's going on in China is going on in a lot of other countries as well. We are seeing Christianity almost sort of gasp its dying breath in Western Europe and in the frozen bits of North America called Canada. It is growing at an exponential rate in South America, which is becoming a Pentecostal continent. The majority of people who go to church on Sunday in South America are going to charismatic Protestant churches. Not Catholic churches, not Baptist, non-charismatic churches. They're going to charismatic Pentecostal churches. And in Africa, for instance, I think this may be the last white pope. The current pope may be the last white pope. You know, it looked for a moment like the Nigerian was going to get it this last time. And I think the next pope will either be Asian or African. And it will reflect the population of Catholicism in the world. So nobody saw that coming. But it's happening, and it's going to have a profound impact on the Christian faith because these people are not liberals. Let me just put it that way. I mean, you know, they're the ones who want to kick the American and the English Anglicans out of the worldwide Anglican communion for departing from the gospel. And the largest church attendance in London every Sunday is a Nigerian Anglican church, which has 6,000 worshipers every Sunday in the east side of London. There are not that many Englishmen going to church anywhere, but Nigerian Englishmen. Any other questions? Got time for one more, I think. Two more, maybe. Depends on how. I'm sorry about my long answers, but it's congenital. When my oldest daughter was six, she asked her mother a question, and her mother said, "You need to ask your father." And Jennifer said, "Mama, I didn't want to know that much about it." Yes. Well, you know, I hate to quote Bill Clinton, but I'm going to. I was in Aspen this summer, and Bill Clinton was talking about the fact. He said, you know how this has got to end? It's just the same tired old stuff on both sides, and you know that in the end, this is how it's going to end. And, you know, we wish they could just get past it and get to the end. I mean, Simone Perez is right. At some point, they've got to come to an understanding. They're going to have to live at least separately, side by side, in the land of Israel, with an Israeli Jewish state and a Palestinian state. Now, I think one of the secrets to this whole attempt at democratization in the Arab world is the secret ballot. Because when Arab women get to vote on secret ballots, they're going to vote for what's best for them and for their children, not what some mullah tells them to do. And I don't think we've paid enough significance to what happened in Iraq, for instance, where you had three times in 1 year, under death threat, they came out and voted in significantly higher percentages than we vote in our elections. Now, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, I think you would acknowledge that the 2004 election was a consequential election. It was what I call a fork in the road election. Like 1980 was a fork in the road election. Like 1960 was a fork in the road election, where America was presented with two forks in the road and they had to decide they're going to take one fork or the other. And we got, what, 55% of eligible voters came out and voted? The Iraqis in that last election had 80% of eligible voters come out. We haven't had 80% vote in an election in the recorded history of the United States. And they were being threatened with reprisal, that they were going to come and shoot them because they had the purple finger. They were threatened with being blown up. They were threatened with being machine gunned. And they still came out and voted. You know, as our president said, it may be that freedom is not the wave of the future. But people who are opposed to it and who think it's not have picked a very odd time to speak that opposition, since there are more countries living under freedom today in the world than any time in modern history. And when people say that the Arab peoples do not want freedom, as far as I'm concerned, that's racism. When you ask the Arabs, and you let them have a chance to have an election where somebody's not going to kill them if they vote the wrong way, they vote for governments that are accountable to them. And this very same arguments were made about the Germans and about the Japanese. I can show you editorials in Time magazine, in the New York Times, in 1945 and 1946 saying, democracy will never work in Germany. They tried it once in the Weimar Republic, and it failed. The Germans are a regimented, militaristic people who worship the martial arts. They will never have a democracy. Well, finally, when we asked the Germans, and we didn't let people say, if you don't agree with us, we're going to kill you. They've had one of the most stable democracies in the world for the last half century. The Japanese, it was even worse. I mean, some of that stuff is really embarrassingly racist, if you look at it today. The Japanese were a primitive, medieval people, a feudal people that had feudal warlords, and that Japan would never accept representative government and democracy. Until we asked the Japanese. And we actually let them have an election where You couldn't kill people if they didn't agree with you. And Japan's had one of the most stable democracies in the world for the last 60 years. People given the choice, an uncoerced choice, will choose freedom. At least we're betting the farm on it. One more question. Yes.
To what extent do you think the U.S. involvement in Israel has increased or plays a part in the tensions between Israel and the Arab nations surrounding them?
I don't think it has anything to do with the tension between Israel and the Arab nations. I think it has a lot to do with the tension between us and Arab nations. These people, majority of them, are sworn to destroy Israel. And to me, one of the more disturbing things, and let me just get this right out on the table, one of the most disturbing developments over the last 5 years is that in the wake of 9/11, there have not been more moderate Islamic voices standing up and saying, these radical Islamofascists don't speak for us. Let me give you an example. There was a school in Arlington, Virginia. It is a school for the children of Arab diplomats who are based in Washington. It's run by the Saudi government, paid for by Saudi money. All of the Saudi diplomats' kids go there, and other Arab diplomats' kids go there. The Washington Post ran a front page editorial 2 years ago in early February, pointing out that the civics textbooks in that school in Arlington, Virginia, said that the world would not end until all the Christians converted to Islam and all the Jews were killed. And it talked about the Jews as monkeys. Now, I'm not saying that there wouldn't be a school that purported to be a Christian school that might teach something like that about other ethnic groups. But what I am saying is they wouldn't do it in the United States without there being an incredible din and outcry, and there would be Christians marching around that school with placards saying, these people are not Christians, these people do not speak for us, these people are blaspheming the Christian faith. And what was deafening, and what continues to be deafening, is the silence of the supposedly moderate Islamic community to that kind of hate and that kind of racism being taught in the name of their religion. Now, I know there are followers of Islam who disagree with it, but they don't speak up. And you know what's scary when I ask some of them? They say, because we're afraid of physical reprisals right here in Nashville. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is unacceptable. When Salman Rushdie had a death threat put on him by the Ayatollah in Iran because of his writings, I defended him on radio. People said, aren't you concerned? I said, my address is 901 Commerce, Suite 550. I'm an American, and I'm not going to live under the threat of some guy coming to shoot me. Here's where I live. We must not put up with that in the United States of America. And anybody who seeks to intimidate through physical violence ought to be put in jail if they're an American citizen, and if they're not, they ought to be deported. Today. Anybody in this country is welcome as long as they play by the rules. And one of the rules is you reject the tactic of killing people who disagree with you. That's not playing fair. Thank y'all.